Good morning, sir. Before we get started, what is your name?
Bobby Tankersley.
Okay, if you just hold on one moment, I believe that the Honorable Mr. Neal is going to conduct your hearing, and you have an attorney you can come call, ma'am. And while Mr. Neal is getting ready to conduct the hearing. And you can just have a seat over there while we're waiting. It's going to take Mr. Neal a few moments to get some of the preliminaries out the way, and then he'll be ready to listen to you, and we'll go from there. Thank you, and welcome.
Hey, good morning, sir. Can you hear me all okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So you know you have an attorney here representing you today.
Jennifer?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Is it Miss Jennifer?
Yes.
Jennifer Ryder, yes.
Okay.
It's okay, sir. I think I left. I got a progress report today from Mr. Tankersley. I managed to meet all my two or three things today, and I left all of my guests on the order.
Let's see.
Because we didn't have one.
Here's one. Here's something that might be helpful.
Oh, okay. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, we just got some this morning.
Yes. Sorry about that, sir. We got some progress report this morning, and I left it laying on my desk. So we shuffled some paperwork, and now I have it. Okay, sir. Would you please state your full name and ABC number for the record?
Bobby Lee Tankersley, 105378.
Thank you, sir. You're appearing before the Oregon Board of Executive Diplomacy this morning in regard to a parole hearing. I'm going to introduce the board members that have conducted a hearing at this time. On the screen to your far left is the Honorable Michael Johnson, then the Honorable Gail Rittenhouse, then we have the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, who's our board chairman, and then all the way to your right is the Honorable Willie Canonis. My name is David Neal, and I'll be your hearing lead this morning. So, sir, I'm going to go over some information, and as I go through it, I'm going to verify it for accuracy. And then once we've gone through the basics on this, it'll be an opportunity for you and your attorney to present any information you have for us today. Okay, so you ready to get going?
Yes, sir.
All right. So you're currently 66 years old, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You're serving a life sentence for first-degree murder, which began on November 22, 1992. You became parole eligible on December 22, 2017, and you were certified for this hearing for regular parole, home arrest, or absolute discharge on October 1, 2018. This will be your third time before the board. You were originally sentenced to 14 years for sexual assault and death for the first-degree murder charge. An appeal in 1994 upheld the convictions. Then in 2008, the sexual assault was vacated. And you were resentenced to 25 years to life for the murder charge. Does that sound fairly correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you were originally convicted by a jury on the two charges. Okay, so I'm going to go over the basics of the allegations as they were in the packet. Okay, I understand that through an appeals process and some DNA evidence and everything else, the situation may have become a little bit murky. So the information I'm giving you is the way it was came down, and this is what the accusations are, okay?
Okay.
All right, so you entered the home of the elderly victim who was basically restricted to a chair. She was very infirm and not very mobile. The allegation was that you brutally assaulted and raped her and strangled her apparently with her own oxygen tubes bite marks on various parts of the victim. And there was actually some tissue bitten off during this assault. So that's the basic allegation. Now, I also understand that back at those days that you had a severe alcohol problem and you were subject to blackouts and you don't really remember the effects. But you don't think, you know, in your own mind, you don't think you could do something like that. Correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And also, the way I read it, the oxygen tube was a more than likely, but not, I don't think the MDO was able to specifically stipulate that that was the actual litigant that what it did was, that was used, although it was the most likely according to the reports back then. And there was DNA evidence, but the DNA evidence that came up was a negative situation, which based on my years as a crime scene investigator, I know that your DNA was not on the oxygen tube. They did not find any, which means your DNA wasn't on the oxygen tube, but it doesn't mean that you didn't use it as a murder weapon. It just clouded the water a bit. Okay? So, the bite marks, I also, from my experience, I think the bite marks are a very subjective subject. There are some times that they're very, very conclusive, and there's other times that if you have five experts testify on the same bite mark, you get five or six different opinions about whether they are or aren't the suspects. So and the reason I say all that is I understand that it is that the bite marks, although there was an expert in the original trial that made statements and everything, other experts dispute the claims and the conclusions that first expert came to. And I understand because it is so subjective. It clouds the water is what it did. So let's at this point in time let's go over some more information past the client itself. Your criminal history went back to 1971, but nothing, not a pattern of this kind of behavior and stuff like that. This was out of character for your criminal history, I might say. They see that you have overall had minimal discipline. But you had two of the last five years. One was for disrupting count in 2015 with an informal resolution, and one for disrespect to staff in 2017, which was a minor violation, but you were found guilty of that. Why don't you tell me about those two tickets that you got, sir? How did you manage to disrupt count that one time?
You know what? I don't remember that one. I remember the second one.
Okay. Well, I've seen disrupting count come up a lot, and I've heard a lot of different reasons, and I understand that it's a ticket that can be easily obtained. So tell me about the disrespect to staff then in 2017.
I am a blind letter A, and I start my routine at like 5 to 4 in the morning. And as I'm just studying up on my bed, the officer's coming around with a flashlight, doing his count, checking IDs. He shines a flashlight in my eyes. I held my hand up over my eyes like this, and I put it down, and he did it again. And that's when I said what I said to him.
What did you say? What did you say?
I said, get the fuck out of my bridge, you fucking fat clown. He was a big fat guy. And it was like, I just wouldn't wait 2 minutes and he could have done that. I wouldn't have done it if I was awake. I wouldn't have said what I did. But he got me off guard.
Okay. So
that's why I use the word, before that word, as a lady, I don't want to repeat the word, but I use that word, and Miss Daniels, the disciplinary officer, said if I hadn't used the word, I wouldn't have got a ticket. And I said, I understand that, because she's known me 20 years. And she said, that's not your character. And I said, I understand that, but it was at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I just stood up by my bed, and he shined a flashlight in my eyes, and it was uncalled for. That's why I did what I did.
Okay.
It wasn't like I assaulted him. I mean, they said I had an anger problem there. You guys did. I went to the anger management class. I don't feel I had an anger problem, but I did the class.
Okay.
That's why I got the ticket.
Okay, well.
Won't do it again.
Corrections officer that was moving town might not have been in the best moves either. Today we have quite a packet that was submitted by
Mr. Maynard.
Yeah, that's it. You got it. Well, Mr. Maynard submitted quite a packet today with information in here. One of the issues last time was placement. You didn't really have anything. You had desires, but you didn't really have anybody that had said that they would take you in. And there's a letter in here from the old federal over in Tucson, which is not really the easiest ones to get into. But you have to have, they have to see that you're not inclined to be a huge problem, that you're somebody that wants to be rehabilitated and get out into society and do well. And we are a good group. And also we see that Mr. Maynard has pretty much guaranteed the finances for 3 months till you get on your feet. And I know old Fredo is one of the ones that they do help you get on your feet as quick as possible. As long as you follow their program, don't violate. And you've got quite a few certificates and some support letter. But I understand you're an aide. You help people that have some sort of disability get around the inmates, get around to pretty much any of their activities. So you might be pushing somebody around in a wheelchair all day to make sure they get where they need to go, and that's the work you do, correct?
Yes, sir. The one I'm taking care of now, he had a stroke when he was in a county jail. When he got here, he needed somebody to take care of, make his bed, do various things for him out of my criteria, my job. I have no problem with that. That's what I do. I make his bed and make sure he goes to chow and I make sure he gets where he's got to go. And I go and check on him a few times during the day to make sure he's okay in his house. And make sure nobody's going to pick on him.
So that's very commendable, sir. There's actually quite a need for people doing that outside of the prison system, too. A lot of people out there that are disabled and don't have any family to help them. So that's the kind of attitude that you would like to see in somebody that is wanting to transition back into the community, because you got a desire to help other people, and that's a long ways from the desire you probably had when you were having all the alcohol problems back when this all happened. So that's a very good sign, and like you say, you've got the finances. I'm gonna see if my fellow board members have any questions at this time, and then what I'll do is I'll defer to your attorney, and she can do any presentations from your side, okay, sir?
Okay.
All right, any questions for Mr. Tankersley?
Thank you, Mr. Hill. So, Mr. Tankersley, what have you done? I mean, you're one of the contentions or the statements by your attorney is that you have had an alcohol problem. Mr. Hill just mentioned that. What have you done to address your alcohol problem?
I did. I was in that box in SMU for 16 years, ma'am. I thought about this problem for a very long time. I've had a lot of time to think about what I was and what I'm going to be when I get out of here. I've been to classes of writing. The basic classes was pertaining to alcohol and drugs and whatnot. I did the classes here. There's really not a lot of available classes that I could go to, you know what I'm saying? I've done what I could do, and I'm hoping, because I've had all this time to think, that I'm going to have my head right when I get out of here. I've done the best I can over here with what I have to work with, so I just know what road I was on. I'm not going back there. I'm going to go this new road now. And by what I'm doing with these people that I'm taking care of now, yeah, I've had five or six of them since I've been here. So I've been here 7 years in this yard. They really need the help, and I feel good doing that job.
Okay, so when you get out, when you're out, the alcohol is not available to you now. But when you get out, alcohol is everywhere. Well, how are you going to stop?
Ma'am, alcohol took me on death row, so did drugs, and I'm not going back there. They got a 12-step program at this whole Pablo thing. I'm going to be in that right away to guide me the best I can. I'm just saying, I'm not the same man as I was. And I surely don't want to go back where I was. If you understand what I'm saying.
Understood. Completely understood. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Neal.
That's all I can say, man.
Thank you.
Mr. Conis.
I just have a follow-up on that question. Mr. Tankersley?
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, sir.
Not to bang this drum, so to speak, but I have a follow-up on your drinking. And that is, I think everyone agrees that you had a drinking problem, regardless of what the courts decided on this case. And my question is, when you entered the Department of Corrections, did you have to go through some sort of detoxification at that? I mean, did you just go cold turkey, or how did you stop drinking?
I came from California, went to the county jail and correctional facility over there in Yuma. I was in there almost 2 years before I got to the Department of Corrections. And I did 2 years before I got there, or a year and 11 months. So I was detoxed when I got there.
And when's the last time you had a drink, sir?
29 years ago, before I came to started this whole thing.
I reckon
I've had testing since I've been here, sir. I ain't had a drink yet since I've been here.
Oh, no, sir. I'm not accusing you of that. But I also know, like, there's the availability of hooch and that sort of thing. And I'm just kind of seeing where you're at in terms of your commitment to a sober life.
May I say this?
Yes, sir.
If I can't restrain myself from doing alcohol or drugs in here, I'm not going to be able to do it out there, sir. I haven't done anything in here.
I think that's a fair statement. Although we do see that for some reason when people get outside of the prison walls, it's not like we haven't seen people relapse. But I still appreciate your argument. I have no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Tankersley.
You're welcome.
Any questions from Dr. Wright?
Thank you, Mr. Bill. Just a couple of three questions. I just want to make sure that I understand, and I think that Mr. Neal, the Honorable Mr. Neal, has done an outstanding job in explaining what happened. But I'm trying to figure out in my mind exactly, did you say to the judiciary system that you were not conscious of what your criminal actions at the time because you were so drunk? I mean, you were on alcohol. Am I correct? So is that basically true or false of what I just said?
I had blackouts, yes, sir, and I don't remember anything about this crime.
You don't remember anything at all about it?
No, sir.
When did you become conscious? I mean, I know you were arrested and all of that, but when did you become conscious that you were being charged with this crime, sir?
When I got to the Yuma facility over there, they asked me, do I understand the charge? And I said, yeah, it's murder. Murder somebody, that's the most I can tell you. I had no recollection of what the crime was about, though, and I'm just saying, if you charge with murder, I know you go to trial court. That's all I understand, because of my past history with being in the system. I knew what was going on. I didn't understand why I was here because I didn't know anything about it.
So you knew absolutely nothing about it. After a while, do you recall, who you were charged with murder and anything? Did you have a relationship with that person?
Well, I lived right there where the murder happened, sir, and I know the elderly lady that this was done to. I know the family and all that. I remember all that. I don't remember going into the room like they said I did and what I'd done. I had no recognition at all.
So in other words, and I guess I'm repeating what I think you said and what I heard, in other words, you just blacked out. You have no idea whatsoever what happened in terms of that murder, sir.
Well, sometimes I'd be blacked out for 2 or 3 days. That's the extent I was an alcoholic.
Now, did you have any psychological or any other type of training or whatever so that you could concentrate or go back and realize that you did commit the murder, if you want to admit it, maybe you don't want to admit it. This is not a trial. We can't retry you, so it doesn't matter whatsoever. But you haven't had anything to make you reflect on what happened, sir, in terms of training?
The 16 years in that box in SMU I've been thinking every day about my life in the past. It's a blank. That's all I can say. What my goals are going to be now.
I know you haven't had anything to drink in all those years, but have you had any blackouts since then, sir?
No, sir. Well, I got a little dementia Alzheimer's coming on, but other than that, no, sir.
Okay. Let me just move on and ask just a couple other questions and just try to get to know you much better than I do, although we've talked with you twice before. This is in theory only what I'm going to ask now. You said that now you're pushing people around, helping people who cannot help themselves, and we commend you for that. That's you really score high in my opinion on that. But you say that you did not have a problem with anger management, although this board, or at least a member of this board, apparently suggested that you needed some anger management training. In theory, you're out now. And you're pushing someone around to help someone, and someone else just walks up and starts cursing them out. How would you react to that, sir, out in the streets?
Cussing me out?
No, cussing the person out who you're assisting. Person in a wheelchair. You're pushing somebody around in a wheelchair, and somebody just walk up and just jump on them. I don't mean physically, but verbally, and start calling them all kind of names and all kind of things. How would you respond to that, sir?
Well, in the first place, that wouldn't happen, but I understand what your question is. I would try to neutralize the problem. I would try to talk to the person as best I could to understand what his problem is or whatever the problem would be. I would try to resolve it. That would be my job. My job is to aid this gentleman to whatever he needs or whatever complex that you're talking about would happen. I see it happen out there. Don't get me wrong, it happens. But I would try to talk to the man. That's what I would do. That would be my job.
Let's ask something else up, man. I don't know if I heard it, what you were saying, sir, for the term that you used. You said about this ticket in 2017 that you got for, you said that the officer, you know, put the flashlight and crashed in front of you. Did you say that it blinded you or something? What happened, you know, for you to react that way?
When I stood up, I was pulling my pants up. I looked over to look at the officer, and he shined a flashlight in my eyes. And I covered my eyes up with my hand and didn't say anything. And then I put my hand down, and he did it again. Now, officer, you warned me from messing with you when I was on death row. And when I left FMU, I went to Rhining, and there was 5 or 6 COs there that knew me from death row. I was an a-hole in that death row, don't get me wrong. You know what I mean? I was that way. I went to these COs and I talked to them. I said, can you have a moment of your time? And they said, yes, Dickerson. I said, well, listen, I apologize if I was an a-hole over there in FMU. I would like to make this clean slate here. I'm not the same person. They said, yes, Dickerson, we've been watching you. I said, I want to make sure everything's good because I was an asshole over there. I'm not the same person. Are we good? And all these officers said, good. And that's the way I deal with that.
Good, sir. Let me just
ask my question. Go ahead, sir. Make you something you ain't or you're not. I'm not the same person I was then. I'm not the same person I was back then. That's what I get. I don't know what else to say.
Okay, I'm just trying to get to make sure that when I vote, that I vote the right way. Okay, now, what do you know, sir? And I guess this will be my final question for right now. What do you know about Old Pueblo, sir? You selected Old Pueblo. Old Pueblo is agreed to, like, with you. So what do you know about them?
I was down at a veterans meeting that they come over here, and all the veterans wanted to go to this meeting. To discuss veterans' issues and whatnot, benefits or whatever. I went to that meeting and my application was rejected because I'm on this SOER in Cook. They didn't understand why I had to be here. I'm not here because I'm an SO, because you understand my SO was dismissed or it's gone. She didn't know that. I explained that to her. And because of the fact that I'm up here, because I have to be, I can't go to general population because of what happens over there with SOs, the stigma of SOs, she understood it. And so I got to talk to her, and that's why my application was then processed and I was accepted. They have no problem with me being there. I wanted to go to the veterans because I'm a veteran. And they have a lot of good opportunities over there.
What type of opportunities do you think that they might have over there that would benefit you, sir?
Well, I got the VA hospitals right there. That's going to be my insurance thing. I understand you have to have insurance when you're out here on the street. They're going to have some counselor and guiding that I can go to talk to because of my my alcohol problem, whatever, and my drug history, and they're going to be able to help me reunite into the society because I don't know anything about society now. I understand that. I just need anybody can help me to understand what's going on out there to get me adjusted to there, and I think they would be able to do that. If I was just to go to a halfway house, my concerns and I'm going to be really paid attention to.
So what branch of the service were you in, sir?
Army.
And what years were you in the Army, sir?
69 to 71.
Did you get an honorable discharge, sir?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Honorable Mr. Neal.
If there is no other questions from the board, I'm going to defer to Mr. Tankersley's attorney and let her decide how the presentation is going to go from here. Come forward and state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. I am Jennifer Ryder, and my partner, Dan Maynard, and I, our law firm has been representing Mr. Tankersley for about 20 years now. And if it pleases the board, I would like to just give a few comments, maybe to follow up on a few of the board's questions and summarize, you know, just a few details about what we think is lined up for Mr. Tankersley should he receive a release from the board. And then I'll address any other questions the board has. I know that you've heard from my partner, Dan Maynard, twice already, and you've heard from Mr. Tankersley already before today and now today with regard to you know, where he is, what he's done since he's been in prison, and what he hopes to do if he is able to get out. And you know a little bit about the background, the facts of the crime. Mr. Neal, you asked some very probing questions about the evidence that was used at the trial. So I'm just going to give, you know, a little bit of a background summary, just, but I don't want to, you know, rehash. I know you have many matters on your calendar this morning, so I'll be brief, and then you can give me any questions you have for me. Just to follow up on what I took a few notes on some of the questions that the board members had in the last few minutes. A couple of things that have gone on with Mr. Tankersley while he's been in prison for all these years. You know, he's really not the same person that he was at the time of this crime in 1991. And I think some of the questions were very probing and telling and interesting about, you know, even our office is representing him in 20 years, we don't know exactly what happened in that, you know, that crime, that murder. And I'm not, you know, saying anything I shouldn't say or that we wouldn't have said in court, but he was having alcoholic blackouts that would last, you know, a good day or so, or a day or two. The murder of this woman happened in a small transient kind of motel where she was living, and Mr. Tankersley was still living in that same motel situation, so he knew everyone that lived there. So he did know the victim, but he didn't have any particular reason that there would have been a motive for this to happen, so he just doesn't remember. He, I think, was rather shocked to hear that he was being charged with this crime because he had always been, you know, a drunk around the place, but never had done anything violent or done anything that would have given you reason to suspect him in this kind of crime. So just following up on what Mr. Neal asked, and I can tell with your investigatory background, you have a lot of information and knowledge about these things, but yeah, there was DNA evidence, but it hadn't really been tested back in 1991 and right after there when the times when they investigated the crime, because DNA hadn't come that far. By the time our office got involved, and really got was able to do our post-conviction work on his Rule 32 proceedings around 2005 and 2006, DNA had come a long way. So, you know, at trial, the state was very clear that the oxygen tubing that this woman had used to breathe was the murder weapon. She was definitely strangled with something thin and tube-like by the way the forensic examiners talked about the marks around her neck were, you know, being strangled with tubing or something like it. They presented that tubing. We were able to go and get the tubing and get it DNA tested. We were able to get the ability to hire a DNA expert from the East Coast, and she came in and it was explained to us that if someone had been gripping and pulling on something like tubing that tightly to strangle someone, there should be something, you know, from their sweat or from their fingers, something, or they would have licked their fingers to hold it tighter in a lot of cases, I understand, from a crime. So, sure enough, there was DNA on the tubing. The victim's DNA, not surprisingly, was on her oxygen tubing, and another male DNA was on the tubing, but Mr. Tankersley was excluded as that. It wasn't one of those where it was inconclusive. He was excluded. So, I think that went a long way with the judge in Yuma in our Rule 32 proceedings, that he was able to be excluded as at least a source of the DNA on the murder weapon. And then he was also excluded as a source of the DNA from behind the victim's fingernail clippings. And again, there was other male DNA. They never had another male suspect that we ever found out about, but there was other male DNA there. Don't know what that was. The bite marks, as you very much, I won't go into that, but yes, you know, Board Member Neal, bite marks are a very kind of subjective source of evidence, and especially in the way that the bite mark testimony was presented. Mr. Tankersley didn't have, he had a defense, shall we say a low budget defense at trial, and the prosecution had three board certified forensic dental odontologists that made a bite mark presentation that was almost like a Hollywood movie. They did a fancy movie presentation to show why supposedly it was his bite marks that were found on this victim. The defense didn't even get to have a dental expert to try to refute them at trial. So it's really not a surprise that the jury kind of went the way of the prosecution on that. When we got our a little bit of funding, we were able to hire a good dental expert, and he went out there, spent hours re-looking at all the evidence and said, yeah, there's really no conclusive evidence to link Mr. Tankersley to any of the bite marks. And in fact, our expert said, you gotta be really careful with bite marks, because a lot of them, what looks like what might be a bite mark may be insect activity on the victim, and that's what a lot of this activity really turned out to be, according to our expert. So anyway, here we are. As a result of all those proceedings that we had on this Rule 32 petition, there was so much doubt and question about whether he was even the person who committed this crime that he has. We were able to get a plea offer from the state rather than the state wanting to retry him with all of this question mark in the air. The state offered us a plea, and that's why we're here before you, because they offered that he could serve 25 to life, and he's now served his 25 years and then some. And here we are. Now, I know your focus here today, a lot of your focus, or some of your focus, is, you know, what, how has he changed, or what kind of person has he become, or what has he done in prison? One thing that I think you all noticed and complimented him on is that he has served as an aide. I think that the prison has certain criteria to obviously allow people to get jobs and work in the prison at all, and to be a hands-on aide with another inmate in the very personal and intimate way that Mr. Tankersley is. I think that tells us that the prison at least feels that Mr. Tankersley is not only not a threat, but someone who can be trusted to care for another inmate, a disabled inmate, in a very personal and intimate way. And I think you guys got the packet that my partner Dan Maynard submitted. In Exhibit 10 to that packet is not one, but three letters from a woman named Dawn Westerfield. Dawn Westerfield, they're very short letters, but Dawn Westerfield is the sister of the inmate that they call him Tank, that Tank helps the disabled inmate. And just reading from one of the letters, she says, Tank has been a blessing to my brother. He not only provides the assistance that is required, he goes above and beyond to help my brother adjust to life in prison. He not only takes him to the chow hall and to the telephones, he even stays with him to make sure he gets back to his unit safely. Tank assists him with making his bed, make sure he picks up his medications, and even clips his fingernails on his right hand, since my brother no longer has the ability to do that with him. And I noticed on the end of her last letter, the one that she recently submitted to you guys prior to this hearing, she says, admittedly, this is a difficult note to write, because losing Tank as my brother's aide would be difficult for everyone, but my faith tells me God has everything under control, and I should let you all know about the type of man that Tank has become since the time I have known him. So I think that between the prison trusting him with such a, I don't know, sort of like a hands-on and really personal role with other inmates, where you, I think there's a lot of trust involved there, and then Ms. Westerfield taking the time and the heartfelt, you know, notes that she's written, that speaks to Mr. Tankersley, and I'm sure he would answer any other questions about all the different things he does. But I think that he has at least come to have a serving heart in prison. He has completed several Bible courses, attended worships, and I think he now appears to be a servant. I mean, a serving heart, and he coming out, going in, if he gets into Old Pueblo, if he gets out and is able to live in Old Pueblo, which he has been accepted, it seems that he does envision helping other people, whether it would be someone else who is incapacitated or in what capacity. I think those are the kinds of things he sees himself doing down the road in society here. And regarding Old Pueblo, I think the board is right. It's not the easiest place to get into. But, you know, Mr. Tankersley looked and found it and was able to talk to them, went above and beyond, you know, made sure he spoke to them and explained his circumstances. And if you look at the information on Old Pueblo, it's a structured place. there's curfews, especially when you're new in the program. It's you have to be in by, I think it's 6 or 7 in the evening. You don't get to have visitors except under very strict circumstances. You cook, you clean, you have certain requirements. You do have to pay money and contribute, you know, by, I think it's on a sliding scale. There's structure there, and I think Mr. Tankersley will do well with a structured situation like that. He's not going to be coming from, you know, 25 to 26 years in incarceration to just freedom on the street where every temptation will be out there available to him. Obviously, Old Pueblo House is a drug and alcohol free facility. There, I believe the people that live there have to be willing to submit to any kind of, you know, testing, but there's no there are no substances, nothing, you know, he won't have any alcohol, at least in the immediate area where he is. And on that point, on the alcohol, they have programs at Old Pueblo that he will be in. In fact, I think Old Pueblo is going to require that he's going to have to do his alcohol 12-step programs. They have substance in his counseling. And they also have some more intensive programs, too, as well, group therapy and individual counseling and other things available, too. In addition, since he's a veteran, and yes, he was honorably discharged, I believe he served in Germany. Maybe you can nod, Mr. Tankersley. He served in Germany and supplies. Yeah, he served overseas for 2 or 3 years, was honorably discharged. So he'll have the ability to go through the VA system and receive benefits there too, which I'm sure will be also, mental health benefits will be available as well. And I can just tell you that my office, you know, there was a point where our work became pro bono on this case, and we have not left. My partner has agreed to, out of his own pocket, put up 3 months of, if you call it rent or housing expenses at Old Pueblo, to get Mr. Tankersley out there and get him on his feet. And we'll also do what it takes to help him sign up and get applications in for benefits. I think he can apply for, and he will be able to, I know he can apply for, and we think he can get Social Security, and potentially maybe something with the veterans as well, but obviously the health benefits there will be available. And he was receiving SSI disability before he went into the prison system. I don't know if the disability portion would apply anymore, but he is obviously the age now where he can receive SSI benefits, and we would want to help him get signed up. And Old Pueblo is very good with helping their residents get into any systems, any benefits that they can as well. I don't want to take any more time if you don't need me to address anything else, but if there's anything that any of the board members want me to answer, I'm happy to answer it.
I'll go just ask it briefly. I'm certainly careful not to turn the burn hearings into trials, and I know that you've heard quite a bit of information about the case, but I do have one follow-up question on that, and that is, we learned about this case that it is a given that he was having blackouts, but during the trial and the appeal, was it proven that he was having blackouts? That he'd been a witness saying, yes, he's been blacked out for 20, you know, that sort of thing, 24, 48 hours?
Good question. Well, so obviously, here's what the evidence was. Mr. Tankersley obviously testified that he had been, you know, in blackouts. There were no eyewitnesses had any, you know, eyewitness testimony about the crime occurring or anything like that that could have, you know, said that he did. Obviously, we'd have a much different set of evidence here if we did. There were some other residents at the facility, and I'm not sure which ones testified at trial or if they did. I can't remember back, and our office didn't handle the trial, so I don't remember. I don't believe there was residents at the motel that testified, but it certainly was common knowledge that Mr. Tankersley was walking around in a blackout state. But I can tell you, we did have some evidence on that in the Rule 32 petitions that we handled. We also obtained an alcohol expert. Her name was Thelma Ross, and she did an affidavit for us that talked about the fact that if he was, based on his history, the time he started drinking, the amounts he was drinking, he started as a teenager and he was drinking, I don't remember how much vodka a day. I remember it was vodka, but I don't remember how much vodka a day he had been drinking, let's say a good amount. And if he had lapses in memory to the extent of having blackouts, and I think to address the chairman's question, kind of like when did you wake up or how did you not, you know, did you kind of have like a memory recall later about what had happened on those days? our expert on alcohol explained to us that you don't really get that memory recall with these alcohol blackouts because it's like a temporary amnesia. The amnesia kind of comes over you for those times when you're in that blackout state from the alcohol. You don't wake up. It's not like repressed memory syndrome or something like that in these other kinds of cases. It's just gone. It's like that amnesia, little piece of your brain has been erased from what happened there. So I didn't fully answer your question.
I appreciate it. And again, it's almost a land of curiosity in this case. It just seems that you can conveniently say, oh, I was a bad drinker, and I blacked out, and therefore I have no recollection without any proof that you were blacked out or had blackouts.
But in this case, there was definitely a lot of circumstantial evidence that supported his position on being a blackout drunk.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yes.
I have one question. On the affidavit that you submitted?
Did my partner, Mr. Maynard, sign? Yes.
Yes. And Mr. Maynard, there's on number 6, it says the state agreed not to oppose Mr. Tanksley's release after 25 years of incarceration. So did they do that in writing? Or?
Yes, I have that, and it may take me just a second to find it. But okay. So, and I'll tell you what that was. As part of our, plea agreement proceedings after we did all the post-conviction hearings in Yuma in, you know, around 2008, once we did all the extra things with the DNA, the bite mark evidence, all of the alcohol, all that stuff, the state, we did a formal agreement with the state, and they, I think, just basically didn't have the heart to go back and try this or the wherewithal to go back and try this case again. So much time had passed and so many questions having been raised now about what they thought was their best evidence that they had had at the time. So rather than, you know, that was one of the conditions that we wanted on it, was that, you know, he's going to serve 25 to life for this crime, and you know that we've kind of thrown out or questioned a lot of your evidence with the work we've done, we at least want you not to come in and oppose his release at the parole hearing when we get to that point. And I see they aren't here and haven't submitted anything, so they seem to be honoring that.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Johnson. I have a follow-up question. And I remember from the last time, when I turned to the business with the state in there, and everybody this time says, well, we looked at it, and we're not saying anything. The last time that caught me is real unusual, but
that's why.
They have to take their position. As far as the DNA, okay, and I'm not questioning what his was there. You say there was male DNA found.
Yep.
Was that ever cross-checked to COLIS for a profile?
Oh, yes, all of the ones that were found. And I'll tell you, by the time we had it done in 2003, actually I have a lab report from 2003, which you could probably interpret yourself, but by the time we had it done, they ran some of the profiles weren't 100% there, like they didn't have all the alleles. So I don't know, I don't remember. There's 19 or 20 alleles, I don't remember. They didn't have all alleles on some of them. Some of them, they only had certain foci, so not all the alleles. The ones that they had a complete enough profile to run the alleles through, they ran and they did not find any matches. So they never found anything conclusive enough. They did find, the ones where I'm saying he's excluded, those are the ones where they had enough alleles, like the alleles that they did find were on those points where they had a DNA point, it wasn't his, like he has DNA that was inconsistent there. So he was able to be excluded, but they either did not have conclusive enough profiles to run everything through CODIS, or, and I say it whichever ones, because I believe on a couple of different pieces of evidence, there were possibly two different male profiles, both not Mr. Tankersley's.
Right.
To the extent they could, they looked in CODIS, but I do remember there was a problem with at least one of them. It did not have enough points that were found. And it was probably because of the deterioration of the evidence over so long.
Well, yeah, I understand that. And one of the big things about CODIS is we had a couple of cold cases that we solved because we went back to the DPS and had the evidence run again. Well, there was one that came up later on that when we had all run, there was a match. But when we put in CODIS like APHIS with the fingerprints, once you put them on one end, it stays there until it's identified.
Ah.
And CODIS is the same way, but the thing about CODIS is that most of that DNA is coming from incarceration, not arrests.
Right.
You know, it's like for a long time juveniles weren't getting identified because nobody was putting their prints in. and then all of a sudden they turn 18, they get arrested for whatever, and boom, and everyone, you know, it's a three-year-old crime, and they're 15, they went out and broke into this car.
And then there's a bench also, yeah.
That is an interesting point. But going back, that you can't, it's really hard to prove a negative.
It's really hard, yeah. It is. But we did have enough to prove that he was excluded on a couple of the really key things here, so we felt like that was enough, and the judge and you have kind of approved of us.
Well, yeah, I mean, most of that puts a lot of blood in the water.
It does do that.
So it's not conclusive either direction, but it's like, well, now, you know, the likelihood either goes up or goes down, but it doesn't go away, unfortunately. Okay, I don't think there's any other questions. This would be a time for the final statements. Did Mr. Tankersley want to make a final statement?
Mr. Tankersley, I was thinking if you'd like to make just a brief additional statement to the board, and maybe I don't want to, you know, do question answer format too much for you, but maybe if you'd like to just tell the board kind of like what I was thinking is, do you want to tell them how you feel that how you've changed, you know, overall, kind of a global perspective, having been where you've been for the last, you know, 20 some years, and then going forward, if you're fortunate enough to be out in the future and be in Pueblo House, are you going to continue to look for opportunities to help people and be a serving person like you have been with the gentleman that you've been helping in prison? Why don't you kind of talk about those 2 points, and then anything else you want the board to know?
Well, I hope I have an opportunity to help somebody out there. And as for who I am now, I'm definitely not the same person. I just know this. 23 years took a lot out of me this time, and I don't plan to do any more of this. This is the last rodeo, what do you want to call it? I just want to go out there and enjoy what I have left in my life. And the opportunity arises that I can help somebody I just know having a murder charge is going to be a little barrier on what I can do out there to help people, because they're going to see that and the red flags are going to go up. I know I'm going to have a hard time understanding what society's like because I haven't been out there so long. I'm just going to do the best I can. And I'm too old to come back to this place, I'll tell you that right now. So I'm just hoping I'm going to have the opportunity that you're going to see give me that opportunity to try to show you I'm going to do what I've got to do out there to make it. I know I'm going to have old Pablo to help me. I have Dan Boehner and Miss Jennifer right here, and as my support groups. If I have any thoughts getting stupid, I'm going to call them up right away and tell them what's going on in my head. I hope it won't happen, but I have no idea what's going to go on out there. I have to be truthful, you know what I'm saying? But I've said, I don't know what else to say. I'm sorry for this to ever occur, but I just know I'm not going to be in the same place again, the same position I was back then ever again. Because I know what made it happen, and being an alcoholic and a little bit of drugs wasn't a nice place.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Tankersley, the board is going to go into discussion now to make a determination. We'll be talking amongst ourselves. You may think we're talking to you, but we won't be. But stay on the phone. Just remain silent. And when we're finished, I'll be right back with you, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, board's now in discussion. This is definitely an interesting situation. It's unusual. Usually the board likes for the inmates to take ownership of the offense based on the power and everything. It appears that Mr. Tankersley can't really truthfully say yes or no, but I do think that Mr. Tankersley is taking responsibility for what he's done, and I think if all of a sudden tomorrow something came up and said, oh, yes, you did it, this definitely means you did it, and found video, and somebody got video and didn't tell us for 30 years, I don't think he would have a difficulty in taking ownership. I think it would be quite a blow to his psyche, but by the same token, the other way around, he's not adamantly denying doing it, and I think his attitude has become a lot more stable than what he probably had back in those days. But he's done quite a good program. I'm impressed with the help he's giving the other inmates. That's not necessarily an easy thing to do. Not an easy thing for most people to push somebody else around in a wheelchair all day. It's tiresome, it can be boring, and it can be totally unrewarding. And so it does take a person with a good disposition to be able to do that. And I really commend him for that. The admission to Old Broadwell is a very good thing. They are very structured. You don't hear too many revocations talking about drugs and alcohol being present in Old Broadwell or some of the other better halfway house programs. So, they are strict. They do require a 12-step. I think that anybody that's got anything in their history of any kind of substance abuse has to do that. But I think with the support of these attorneys, and I include the financial support, as well as, supporting them with any litigations or anything done, I'm currently would be in favor of the possibility of home arrest for Mr. Tankersley. I'm almost always a little bit on the fence to release inmates after this long, but it's also quite a process to transition back into society after 20-some years in prison. But I would like to see if there's any discussion from my fellow board members on this. Mr. Canone.
Just thank you, Mr. Neal, just to continue the discussion. Like you, I'm a bit on the fence. I'm not firmly opposed. I think I have a little bit of concern about Mr. Tankersley being a little bit surly, although, truth be told, it's not like I haven't known members of the law enforcement, military, and intelligence communities who I couldn't describe the same way and had very similar attitudes. And his discipline is pretty limited, considering how long he's been inside the Department of Corrections, but that sort of disorderly, disobeying, disrespect, disobeying. He only has four managers, but I guess it's hard for me to look completely past that attitude. But I am open, and I'll just continue from there.
Mr. Mass. Thank you, sir. I'm not hearing the attitude at all, so I'm just not hearing it. So, and I would just want to point out for the record that we do have a letter from Yuma County, and it's dated April 4th, so it would be for the last hearing, not this one, but it's in the packet. And there are two points I would want to point out from this letter. And one of them is just that you mentioned earlier, Mr. Neal, that there's a sentence, after reviewing the record that inmate Tankersley has compiled, the state opts to decline to make a recommendation. So they're, at this point, not taking a position. But they also, the next paragraph says that we are seeking to locate any family member of the victim. If we locate a family member who wishes to contact the board, we will assist.
So it appears that no victim relative has come forward either. So that plus the fact that Mr. Tankersley is a veteran with an honorable discharge and will have that additional support, which many people would not have. In fact, most inmates do not have that, and I think that's a little something in his favor, so I could support home arrest.
A comment about the veteran status. According to what Mr. Tankersley told the PO during the pre-sentence report, in that he was dishonorably discharged for drug abuse, and that was later, according to Mr. Tankersley, converted to a general discharge, not an honorable discharge. And that was because he self-admitted to using drugs, but he was never caught in possession of. And that's information that he gave the PO. How accurate that is, I don't know.
I wasn't aware of that.
Right. Well, I mean, it's in the pre-sentence report, and I make a point of saying that the pre-sentence report says that Mr. Tankersley said that, and it's not in his research or anything else. But it looks like at worst case scenario, it was a general discharge, which usually, I think, for medical and stuff like that, it's still, you know, it's same kind of benefits.
Yeah.
And everything. So.
Okay, Dr. Wright, anything you'd like to add?
Well, of course, I'm on the fence on it. I know that he made progress. He's not the same person. I mean, I'm forced to admit that he's a different person now. I guess maybe it's just me. I'm still concerned about, although it was a minor, 2017. Just a short time ago, that still concerns me. The behavior, I know it was 4 o'clock in the morning, but he was incarcerated. This officer came by with a flashlight or whatever he had, and he just reacted as if he was out on the street somewhere, and I'm still a little concerned about that, but. I'm still on the fence, but that still concerns me, that how would he react out in the real world, even at a program as good as Old Pueblo. I think we all admit that, I would admit that Old Pueblo is a good program. We're familiar with Old Pueblo, but that still concerns me, that for him to be out after just a little better than a year and with that type of behavior, I just can't comprehend it. That's just one bullet. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and make a motion and see where the votes land. I'm going to move to grant Mr. Tankersley arrest, deny their control, and deny absolute discharge.
I'll second.
Agree.
I disagree.
And Dr. Wright.
I'm going to disagree, sir.
So that would be three agreeing to a disagree, so that would carry the motion. And for conditions of release, one of the things that I think would be very appropriate this time is target as needs assessment, referral, counseling, or whatever is appropriate, but for anger management. And that's a lot because but after being in for so long, that's not a bad thing for anyone to go through. failed to follow all mandatory DOC conditions and sanctions, no alcohol use, random tests for drugs and alcohol. May not operate a motor vehicle initially. And I'm going to put one on half an hour and put down one of the local codes. He has that approved. I believe there was like a $2,100 restitution risk in there.
There was a restitution.
Yes.
160.
Divided restitution. And partake in available programming as directed. So, Mr. Tankersley, the board is voted to grant you home arrest. Which we like to make this very, very clear. Home arrest means you're still an inmate. You'll have an ankle bracelet on, you'll have a very strict itinerary rules. It is not real easy, but you're still considered an inmate when you're on home arrest. So you have to be very, very careful about following the rules and stay in contact with your PO. They'll explain all itinerary requirements and what you have to do. And the people at Oakville, I think, are fully aware of that stuff, and you know, on their end can help you. But you, some inmates get out, they get in a big hurry to get back into society, and they start violating the rules about GPS, and it gets them in trouble. And it's not because they want to do anything bad, it's just they want to do everything good, and they get just not enough hours in the day to do everything, and they say, well, okay, it won't matter, and they violate their home zone, or they stop somewhere they're not supposed to. But very, very, very strict. And at about a six-month point, you'd be notified of another hearing once the DOC certifies you. You come back before the board, and we see how you've been doing. And hopefully, we don't see you before that on any kind of revocation. But do you do understand that the board is kind of split on this, which means there are some doubts out there, so there's more reason for you to really pay attention to what you're doing and behave yourself and prove that our two dissenting members were close but not on the mark. Okay? Do you understand all that?
Yes, sir, I do.
Mr. Neal, forgive me if you mentioned it. Did you mention the supervision fee?
I didn't, but I will.
Yeah, we need to get that on there.
There's also a $65 a month supervision fee, which is required, and but you won't. It's after 60 days that you'll have to start paying that on a regular basis. That gives you an opportunity to get into a position of employment, hopefully. One thing I'm going to say is, you've been in for a long time. You generally have friends in prison, but be careful about who you tell that you are going to get released, because some of those people will get jealous and try to get you to do something you don't want to do, and then you won't get out. Okay? And the board has no control over that part of it. If you do something wrong and they give you a ticket or something, then you're going to be stuck. But the other thing is, it's not immediately either. You won't get out tomorrow. There's a processing time and get everything set up with Old Pueblo, and be paying close attention to that. They have some real strict rules about how fast you have to report in to them and their phone numbers and everything else. And too often we get revocations and say, well, I didn't understand. Well, they don't read the paperwork. So, but you're fortunate you've got a couple of attorneys to help you decipher all that stuff and make sure they don't want to get mud on their face from this and slap in the face because you do something wrong. So they're gonna be on you. So you have three or four more POs while you're out there for me. Okay, sir. This is going to end your hearing. We do wish you the best of luck. And in about 6 months when we see you again, we want to hear lots of good things. Okay?
I'll talk to my parole officer about that hearing then, right?
Well, then what happens is Time and Talk automatically certifies people for the different type of hearings when the timing is right. And so you'll come up in about 6 months. And if not exactly on that date, but then as they get scheduled, you get an opportunity to come back in. And your PO should come in and tell us just what a wonderful inmate you've been and what a remarkably good record you have. Okay?
I understand. I thank you.
All right, well, thank you. And we'll see you in about 6 months.
All right.
Please give the phone back to the CO3, please, sir.
I will do that.
Thank you.